Hi there, I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane. If y'all are looking for a little American magic,
then put away your athames and wands and dig out your box of roots, stones, and bones.
This is New World Witchery. In this episode, we have an interview with renowned root worker Kat Ironwood.
In witchcraft, we're going to discuss soap making and its magical uses.
And in Spelled Out, we'll talk about cleansing and purification baths.
On New World Witchery with us today, we have a real treat. We have one of the premier authorities in hoodoo today discussing the subject with us. She is the proprietress of the Lucky Mojo website, shop, as well as dozens of other sites, some of which we'll name here in just a minute. But I'd like to say a very warm welcome and a very big thank you to our guest, Kat Ironwood.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for agreeing to it. All right. Well, first of all, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about your shop and your other sites. You've got LuckyMojo.com, I know. Southern Spirits, which I spend a lot of time reading.
Yeah, Southern Spirits is a sort of an academic repository of 19th and early 20th century material about African-American folk magic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Southern-Spirits.
Yes.
Just for those who are looking it up, .com. And I have another one, Herb Magic, herb-magic.com, which is all about the use of herbs in mm-hmm. hoodoo. And at Lucky Mojo, there are a bunch of subsites. Back in the day when it was very difficult to buy domains, I had to make them all subsites of one domain. Now you can buy a domain for nothing. But since everyone built links to those subdomains, I've kept them. So luckymojo.com/sacredsex.html is a sacred sex website that's fully contained within Lucky Mojo. There's another one, luckymojo.com/luckyw.html, which is a site, a fully contained site on lucky charms and amulets from around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I have arcanearchive.com, which is a cache of posts, mostly from Usenet and from old bulletin boards back in the 80s and 90s, on the subjects of magic, worldwide magic. Mm-hmm. Ceremonial magic, folk magic, and different religions and mysticism. I have another site called the mystictearoom.com. Mystic Tea Room is about tea leaf reading. We really are kind of have a lot of these things, and we've done a lot of them.
And they're all fantastic. I've spent a lot of time on the various sites, and you've just done such a great job with that.
There's another one, ironwood.org, which is spelled like our last name, YRONWODE. .org, which is the official outlet for the Ironwood Institution for the Preservation and Popularization of Indigenous Ethnomagicology, which is YIPI. That's an acronym, YIPI. Mm-hmm. And that is a nonprofit. And what's at ironwood.org is mostly bibliographies on books on magic, bibliographies, books on dowsing, books on Ouija boards, whatever. And these are just sort of academic site for people who want to get primary source information and need a bibliography.
That's wonderful. You've told me something that's probably going to occupy most of my time now for the coming week. I love those kinds of things. And you also run the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church, is that correct?
That's correct. Missionary Independent Spiritual Churches is a small denomination of spiritualist New Thought churches there are two churches in our denomination. The other one, the mother church is Missionary Independent, and then the newest church is Four Altars Gospel Sanctuary, which is in Joshua Tree, California. Huh. And these are small churches where we set candles and lights. We're run by a regular board of bishops. Bishop Fred Burke is in charge of the other church, the one in Joshua Tree in the desert. And we baptize people. We do weddings, funerals, and so forth. And we set lights. We do spiritual contact with spirits of the dead or with angels on behalf of people. And we do divination of all types, including scrying with crystal balls, tarot cards, and other forms of spiritualist mediumship. And we also have an organization called the Crystal Silence League, which is a method by which we send out affirmative prayers and healing prayers to people who themselves have a crystal ball. And all we need to do is attune our crystal ball to their crystal ball, and we send it out prayers for them.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's accessible through the Lucky Mojo website as well?
Well, yes, it has its own website. It's missionaryindependent.org. And we're one of many, many spiritualist churches in America. We're just a very small denomination. But we also use a lot of new thought type things, too. In other words, affirmative prayer and that kind of stuff. And we happen to be, the church itself happens to be the smallest church in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been listed that way. There's a company called, an outfit called RoadsideAmerica.com, and they've listed us as the smallest church in the world, which we are. So people come by just to see us for that reason, without any regard to the spiritual work we do. And the church is right next door to Lucky Mojo, which is the shop, which is an old-fashioned hoodoo candle shop. And it's somewhat in the nature of a, well, you know, it's kind of a, it's a real functional candle shop. I mean, we have 10 people, we're making things all day long. We make oils, powders, incenses. We make everything for people on the spot. We have candles and curios of all types, books, tarot cards, you name it, it's a regular shop. But it also is outfitted as a historical reenactment shop. In other words, if you went to Colonial Williamsburg to buy a candle, you'd be getting something in that, you know, which came out of that time period. And what we've done here is recreate an old-fashioned candle shop of the 1920s or 30s.
How did you manage to find all the sort of original material to base that on?
Well, I'm a collector, and I'm a graphic designer and a writer. And I've worked in the comic book business for about 26 years. I'm very sensitive to art, and I began looking for original artwork. Wherever you see something printed, a label or something, there's original art. And I collected original art for advertising art and poster art. I have quite a collection of it just for my own pleasure. And some of the art that was done for some of these older hoodoo or conjure supplies out of Chicago and out of Memphis, the artwork is available. I mean, you can find it. Some of the best art was done by a graphic designer and artist named Charles Dawson. He was an African-American painter and a fine arts gallery-type painter. And when the Depression came, he went into commercial art because, you know, he needed to earn money to support his family.
Mm-hmm.
And I collect Charles Dawson's art, so I began cleaning it up, you know, photographing it, cleaning up, and putting it on labels. It's out of trademark and out of copyright. It's been so long. And I would redesign it. Sometimes I would, you know, change things around. I just found art, and I began to just create these labels that looked like they came from the 1920s and 30s. I also hired artists, people I know, Steve Lealoa, for instance, Trina Robbins, people I know in the comics business who can draw in an old style, and I would just give them an assignment to draw me a label that looked like it came from the 20s or 30s, and they did.
And the labels look great. They're so vivid. They pop right off the product.
Well, thank you.
Beautiful.
That's just part of my, you know, my basic skill set from working in comics and working as a graphic designer and in typography. I've done that for a long time. I've been a typesetter.
Oh, neat.
I love that kind of stuff.
My wife loves that quite a bit, too. She gets very into fonts, so.
Yeah, I'm a font freak, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, like Cobble Ultra is our, you know, the font that we use on most of our labels. And, you know, people go, what are you talking about? Oh, Cobble Ultra. But all of the recipes that we got and that type of stuff came out of my lifelong collection of folklore and folk medicine. I'm just a collector of information. And, you know, I would write down formulas that people would give me or watch them make something in their shop, and I'd write down what I think they were making it, and then I would test it at home. You know, you can do perfume testing with tester strips, and you can see how close you are to copying what someone else has. And I started doing that back in the 1960s so that I would have access to different formulas. And, you know, it's like, does everyone make money drawing oil the same way? The answer is no. And so I got a lot of different formulas for money drawing oil, and I would just sort of play around with them. And so a lot of the formulas that we use are very old-fashioned. A lot of them come out of my own past collecting. And in some cases, I interviewed older people who had worked in the hoodoo business, the business of running an occult shop, back as early as the 20s, and asked them for formulas. If they were retired, they would sometimes give them to me. So the idea was to keep something traditional going. And the earliest of our formulas for the oils go back to the 19th century.
So how did you get into hoodoo and folk magic? Did you have a family connection to that already, or is it just something that you got really fascinated by?
Well, I'm what's called a polymath, if you know what that is. That's a person who is interested in multiple things.
Mm-hmm.
And So I'm an unusual person. This is not to boast or brag. I'm just trying to explain myself as if I were a specimen. When dealing with me, people often say, gee, she's like someone with Asperger's. I think that may be a pretty accurate. I'm not like an average person. I have to explain that because people say, how did you get into that? You might as have easily asked me, and I have recently been interviewed, how did you get into comic books? How did you get into collecting teacups? Whatever. I can't explain it other than to say I've always been like this. Now, as far as my family background, I come from a family that is bohemian and academic. On my mother's side, German Jews, with family names like Erlinger and Cohn and Reichenstein and so forth, from around Nuremberg and then Munich. On my father's side, Sicilians, who probably were conversos, probably were Jews, but had become Catholic when 1492, when Spain owned Sicily and they made a rule that all the Jews had to either convert or leave. The last names, Gian Grasso, Manfredi, Prococo, these are just, Sicilians. But they look more Jewish than they look Italian. And my father was an artist and very left-wing politically. My mother was a poet and a librarian and a writer and very left-wing politically. They met. They had me. My grandfather was a lawyer, a trademark and copyright lawyer, and he was interested in folklore. That was his hobby. He was Jewish, but his hobby was Christian folklore. He had a huge collection of Catholic Bavarian folk art. I mean, vast museum quality stuff. That was his hobby. And he encouraged me to collect folklore from, as he put it, your little playmates. And I collected folklore from my little playmates. And I happened to grow up in a town called Berkeley, California, which was multiracial, multicultural. A lot of people came there for the university. My mother worked at the university as a librarian. When I was young, she was going to library school there. And we lived in an area where a lot of the students, the graduate students, lived with their children. And so there were people from all different cultures. There was a little boy who only spoke Russian who showed up, and there was Mexican-Americans. And these would have been families who had been in California prior to the making of California a state. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of African-Americans whose families had come to Berkeley and Oakland during World War II to work in the shipyards. These were families from the Gulf area, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas. They had shipbuilding or ship repair skills, and they were moved up to Richmond and Oakland to work in the shipyards. And so their children, who are my age, were there in school. And there were a lot of children. There were Chinese children. Their families had, when Mao took over China as a communist country, the scientists and Chinese people interested in democracy came to America. So we were in a very unusual place with a lot of children of university students and graduates. So my grandfather telling me, collect the folklore of your little playmates, meant a lot of different kinds of folklore.
Mm-hmm.
And I became kind of obsessed with it. He pointed out to me that there would be jump rope rhymes that would differ by the children's races and skin colors and cultures, and that some would not even have jump rope rhymes, and that there would be different hopscotch, and they would call hopscotch Potsy or hopscotch or some other different name for it. And he kind of showed me that, and I kind of went wild with it. And then I also am a musical obsessive, and my family on my mother's side are all musical obsessives. It's pretty humorous, actually. We're just totally obsessed with music. So as a musical obsessive, I chose a form of music which was not real popular in my family, which was solidly in the camp of Mozart, and I went off into blues music and early country music. And because of that, I wanted to buy a rhythm and blues music that I heard on the radio on KDIA Lucky 13, which was a black-owned station in Oakland. And then to do that, I had to go down to Oakland to buy the records. And to save money on the bus fare, I walked. And while walking, I walked by a shop that had a sign on it that said, Candles, Spiritual Supplies, with a little image like a little leaf between the word candles and spiritual supplies. It was hand-lettered on the glass. And I walked in to see what that was, because that sounded real odd. Candles, spiritual supplies, didn't get it. So I walked in and realized I was in a shop of a kind I'd never been in before, and I was about 14 years old. So I asked around, and they were very friendly to me, and I told them what I could buy and what was there, and I started going back. Every Saturday, I'd go buy a record, and then I'd, some Slim Harpo record from Louisiana or something, and then I'd buy these country supplies. Later, I was writing a book on Lucky Charms, and I happened to write a page about John the Conqueror Root, just mentioning it was a lucky charm of the African-American culture in America. And I think this was along with things on the Evil Eye and things on, Manekaneke, the little good luck kitty, the beckoning cat. Mm-hmm. It was like part of a much larger world folkloric, material culture of world folklore, more or less cataloging my collection of thousands and thousands and thousands of good luck charms. So I put this one up, but it had not been up for about a week when a woman phoned me and asked me if I could get her a John the Conqueror Root. And I thought, that's odd. She was black. She was from the South. She was working for the U.S. government in Washington, D.C. And I said, why don't you just go down, get one at Clover Horn? Because I happen to know there was a place in Washington, D.C. that sold it. She goes, well, that's in a kind of a bad part of town now, and I don't go down there. She goes, could you send me one? I said, sure. I sent her one for free. Mm-hmm. She called me right back, and she said, can you send me 10 of them? And I said, well, then I'd have to buy them and sell them. So I decided to buy them and sell them, and that's what led to Lucky Mojo. And at the time, I did some searches on the World Wide Web, and I found that Alta Vista was the only search engine back then. This was before Google. Mm-hmm. And the word hoodoo appeared nowhere on the World Wide Web, which I thought was odd. The word conjure appeared, but it usually was in the reference to stage magic, or just the word to meaning something to appear suddenly. Mm-hmm. The word witchcraft was used mostly by neo-pagans. And the word root work mostly either applied to chakra work, the root chakra, or it applied to computer work, root work. And so I picked the word hoodoo of all of those words that I knew, being the rarest word, I could then judge my progress on Alta Vista. So I began because the words conjure, root work, hoodoo, they're used somewhat interchangeably, and even witchcraft and sorcery. So I just began to write about it to see what would happen, and suddenly there were pages and pages of my work that were being cataloged by these search engines and nobody else's work. And it was almost 3 years before the word hoodoo appeared with somebody else's web pages. And now it's become very popular. Now everybody talks about, oh, hoodoo this, and cats miss hoodoo that, and whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of one of those funny things. You know, it was sort of an experiment to see if I could reflect back into the world and bring into the... You see, as everything was converting to electronic and digitized, you don't want to lose parts of culture. So I thought, I'll be the champion of this piece of culture, which is not represented. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, and I think you've done an amazing job.
I have to explain here about me. There had been no articles on 16th century Spanish literature, and I happened to know about it, I would have started a big website on that, but I don't happen to know about that one.
That's not part of the polymath skills.
I'm not too good with other languages. I'm just into English. But but for instance, that the whole thing on the Lucky Charms was part of this program of bringing things into the digital age. I have this whole site on sacred sex. I all these different sites that I built were really about downloading the content of my brain onto what I perceived as a very good new system.
Mm-hmm. Sort of an archiving project.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sometimes feel like I have been replaced by Google, although Google is not yet as connective as me. But before Google, people just would phone me at random. And what's the recipe for hot sauce? Or how do you do this? How do you trim a kerosene lamp? I'm a person who apparently knows all this stuff.
That's fantastic.
It's just a kind of mentality. There's other people like me. I mean, I'm not alone, and I'm not unique in any way. I'd say about 1% of people in the world have this capacity, maybe less, maybe a lot less. I don't know, but I like to think that 1% of us are out here. But anyway, I have that capacity, and so I thought with this exobiological thing, with the digitizing, we could put everything together. And then when search engines came along, and especially when Google came along, which was quite a bit into this project for me, I went, this is perfect, because now anyone can find anything, and I can die content. They no longer need to phone me in my grave and ask me what's the meaning of a Hamsa hand, because I've already written it down.
Mm-hmm. And it's fantastic stuff. I mean, the site is great and the articles are wonderful.
Well, thank you. I it's funny. In some ways, I feel like I've been, you know, people say, how do you earn a living doing this? Because they think I do. I don't. I do not earn a living doing this. I just write for 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. It's just what you feel called to do, I'm sure.
It's just what I do. Yeah, it's just me. But I do try to earn a living by teaching courses, and the Hoodoo class is how mm-hmm. I earn a living. The shop is truly a nonprofit, although it's not legally a nonprofit yet. I hope to get it there. The shop is a demonstration mm-hmm. of a shop. It's simply to show what a shop is like. You know what I'm saying?
Right. It's that historical reenactment aspect that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, it keeps 10 people occupied and employed and you know, 10,000 people in our database. We really are popular.
Right.
It's great. You know, it's great. We sell everything at absolutely the lowest price we can. Everything handmade, everything prayed over, everything made by students of mine, learned how to do it the way I was, you know, shown how to do it back in the 1960s. And those people that I was learning from, you know, they had picked it up in the 20s through 40s. Mm-hmm. The oldest teacher I have actually, I hate to say, I think he may have passed away by now, but this man was very old. He learned from a man in the 1940s who himself had lived into his 90s and had been born in slavery. So mm-hmm. I can say that I have some legitimate contact with that era of 19th century root work.
Mm.
And to me, that's something to pass along. You know, I hate it so much that people forget history.
Yes, know? Yes, absolutely.
They just don't get it. I mean, people are so stupid sometimes. And they, you know, they do the same things over and over and over again, same mistakes, stubbing their toe on the same rock. You know, it just drives me nuts. So I figured that with this new technology, maybe we can learn something, you know. And one of the things we have to learn is what we've done in the past. And so there's no reason to forget anything now. It'll all be remembered. Isn't that great?
I love it. I love that.
that's my goal.
I think you're doing a great job. Okay,
well, thanks.
Getting back to Hoodoo a little bit, with the cultural identity that you were talking about, you have, like you said at Berkeley, there was that very mixed sort of ethnic background. And I know that you're one of the people who very much says that anyone can do Hoodoo. I'm not sure I say that.
I'm saying anyone can do Hoodoo who's willing to enter African-American society.
Okay, and that's something I'd really like to discuss.
Yeah, I need to talk about that because this is something that has been a problem for me. I'm obviously not black. I will say out front, when I was young, I pretty much restricted my dating to either Jewish or black guys. That was just my choice.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I branched out. I had a few that were not, you know, and right now I'm married to a guy who's kind of a bizarrely, you know, American mixed of mutt or mongrel type mm-hmm. person, a Native American, black, Scots, Irish, Norwegian. But he's probably the most, quote, white guy, unquote, I've ever been with. But, you know, so I had a particular interest. That was social. That was personal. And I learned about this stuff by being in that culture. Now, that's important to understand. So when I said reflecting back, what I really meant was literally reflecting back what I had learned from storekeepers, from the old grandmothers, from my friends, from my school friends. I reflected it back as accurately as I could using a skill that I happen to have, which is verbal facility, right? And that's mm-hmm. just and also I can make linkages, and I've got a really good memory, and I can say so-and-so said this and so-and-so said that and put them together and say, look at how these are similar or different. You know, that's what I do. But I never, never intended this to become the plaything of neo-pagans.
Mm-hmm.
That was never my intention. And I didn't think they'd even be interested. You know what I mean? Now, mm-hmm. I have nothing against neo-pagans, but what's happened to my shock and dismay is that a lot of people have come into this and go, oh, Hoodoo, anyone can do that. Yes, there are a lot of white people who do Hoodoo, but if you look into their families, they're doing Appalachian-type folk magic. But if you look deeper, you'll find that they're almost all part Native American and or a suppressed part black.
Mm-hmm.
And now the Native American component is what's really been my discovery, that this is pulled out of pulling it out of the salad, you know what I mean, saying, oh, look at this mm-hmm. lettuce leaf. This is different than that other lettuce leaf, right? Mm-hmm. We're not talking about a melting pot. We're talking about a salad, right? So when you think about Africans coming over from Africa as slaves, stripped naked for the most part, they could not bring their herbs and roots with them, but many of them were herb doctors, root doctors, both medically and magically. They had various religions. Some had been converted to Islam. Many of them were Christian, especially from the Congo, because Congo had become Christian in the 1400s. Mm-hmm. And many of them had indigenous religions, including the indigenous Congo religion, the indigenous Yoruban, indigenous Uefan, so forth, different. You know, even some of the early, very earliest slaves in the 1500s came from Ethiopia and were Coptic Christian. And there was a lot of Africa is vast, okay? So there are a lot of different African folk magic traditions and folk religion traditions, as varied as, for instance, the difference between a Sicilian and a Norwegian, right? They're very different. So these all, but they're all stripped naked and they all come over. They have a memory of certain ways of working, but they don't have their herbs or roots. Now, they can't even convince their white masters to bring those herbs or roots over, even if they have, oh, so-and-so's a doctor, he knows how to set bones. Why can't they bring the herbs and roots over? Because they're tropical. Those will not grow in colonial Williamsburg or New York State, and or even in the Georgia Sea Islands. So when you are stripped naked and brought to a country and you are expected to do for your people on a plantation to do the healing, what do? You look around. Well, who does the healing? It sure ain't the masters, because they don't know, right? They're clueless. They besides which, they're English and come from a different climate and do different things. And they're not going to let you into their thing, but there's Native Americans who are now dispossessed, have no homes. Many of them have been made into slaves. Many of them are still living in an uncivilized, quote-unquote, wild Indian condition out past, you know, in the Ohio Valley or in Kentucky, or they've run away. They've joined dragging canoe, and they've gone off to live on the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And a lot of slaves ran away to join them. So there's a tremendous amount of intermarriage between Native Americans and black people in the South, and the Native Americans knew all about the herbs that grew in the South. So when we talk about hoodoo, when I was young, I thought it's black, it's all from Africa. It is black American, but it's not African. Mm-hmm. It really is, I'd say, a good quarter of what's in hoodoo is Native American tricks, Native American routines, Native American use of herbs. Now, a lot of white people have part Native American, and so they contain some of that material, too, in their families. And that's why they look at it and they go, this is so familiar. I'm not black, but why are we doing the same thing? Mm-hmm. They need to look to the Native American component in their own families. And this is the submerged or buried truth that I brought. When I started teaching, I had no idea I was going to find this out. But like my grandfather said, you just watch what your little playmates are doing, and you begin to find out. And so these are not people who would openly declare as Cherokee. In fact, sometimes they're embarrassed and say, well, we're part Native American. I don't know what tribe, but my family was from North Carolina. You know, something like that. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, are you black? Are you white? Are you mixed? Well, we don't know. We don't talk about race in my family. Those people, sometimes referred to as, and you must pardon me for saying this, hillbillies, sometimes referred to as poor white trash, those people often carry some of the same magical traditions as African Americans do for various reasons. And then there are other components to hoodoo, Jewish components, because of these Jewish shopkeepers, pharmacy owners, who want to be friendly. Oh, you like the Bible too? Well, there, let me tell you something from Psalms, you know. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden all this work from Psalms, which is Jewish folk magic, enters hoodoo. So that's another bit. Then there's Chinese bits where you have, like in Oakland where I grew up, the Chinese ghetto and the black ghetto were right next to each other. All of a sudden you have this whole thing, the blaxploitation film cult, and you have all these black guys doing kung fu.
Right.
Right? Uh-huh. And it's like, and they're using Chinese medicines. And you're like, well, that was interesting. But it also enters into hoodoo. The use of bagua mirrors, for instance. A lot of people, but not everywhere. They won't do that in the Georgia Sea Islands, but they will do it in Oakland, and they will do it in New York, where the Chinese ghettos and the black ghettos are together. Or the Sicilians. You've got the Sicilian fishermen. They're in San Francisco Bay Area. They're in New York. They're in New Orleans. And Sicilians are known for being very casual about marrying black people. They don't have a big racist thing going in Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll find a lot of mixed marriages in the 20s, 30s, and 40s at a time when that was considered rather daring or unusual to do, and there were places where this was allowed. And so you'll find a lot of Sicilian folk magic mixed into hoodoo. It's just sort of a like I said, it's a little salad there with all these different little pieces, and you can pick them apart and go, oh, look at that, that's Jewish. Oh, look at that, that's Sicilian. Look at this, this is Native American. But most of the big lettuce leaves are African and Native American. And, of course, they're also the Germano-British, the slave masters, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they have their own little rhymes and songs and their own little folk ways, and they, you know, maybe they teach it to a house slave who then teaches it to her children, and so it ends up in that black family.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at, really, the history of America. So now, when people say to me, anyone can do hoodoo, but you have to pay respect to the people who kept it going.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not the white people. They dropped it just like a hot potato. It was not the Native Americans tended to be walled off and put on reservations in a later time period. The people who kept alive were black people and some very country, isolated, white-identified people who mostly were part Native American, maybe part black.
Mm-hmm.
Melungeons, they're called sometimes.
Right, up in the Appalachians, the Melungeons.
Right,
and then
right.
That's the
people who kept this. But they don't have as much African. It's always kind of a mix. Is it, you know, when you do a trick, is it like if a trick calls for sulfur, you know you're talking something African or Sicilian. If a trick calls for Wahoo bark, you know it's Native American.
Mm-hmm.
See? You can look at it. You can take it apart. So we're looking at a very large mixed. You know, people say, well, why aren't you studying Santeria? I don't know. I'm not interested in Santeria. I've been interested in America. I'm American. But Santeria is some black material mixed with some Spanish material, Catholic, and it's in Cuba.
Right.
But it doesn't have the Cherokee component because there are no Cherokee Indians in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be different. Jamaican folk magic, Obia, looks more like hoodoo because the people are more the people are from the Congo than from West Africa. And they're among English-speaking slave owners, but then they don't have the Cherokees again, or the Caddo Indians, or the Seminoles, or whatever it's going to be. And so there's a little, it's different, but it's very similar. And in fact, by comparing Jamaican and African-American, you can see what you can really quickly, specializedly take out the African part and the English part. They kind of rise right quick.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a little bit of Hindu mix in the Jamaican because Britain controlled India and they brought over a lot of Hindus.
Oh, I've never thought of that.
Yeah. You gotta look at the history. It's all about the history. So folk magic is worldwide. Anyone can play. I mean, I can pick up some Taoist thing if I want to. I can pray to a Taoist god and make a Taoist amulet as good as the next white gal. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, always pay respect to where you got it from.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that. I talk with Hindus all the time, and they're like, why are all these neo-pagans worshiping my god? I don't know. They thought your god was pretty looking? I don't know. I mean, you know, you have to ask them each individually. But we do have to pay respect, and we should not say it's all the same thing. It's not a big stew where everything has been, you know, it's not baby food where everything's been ground down and blanderized into one homogenous mess, you know. So I teach hoodoo to anybody, and anyone can do hoodoo, but they can't do it well if they don't have black friends and are not understanding that it is African-American and it is part of black culture in America.
Mm-hmm.
That's my statement on that. A long answer to a short question. I apologize.
But a great answer. And another thing that I know that you've said on other interviews is that to be comfortable with doing hoodoo, you also have to be, I think, comfortable with Jesus was how you phrased it?
Well, yeah, because after all, what is hoodoo? Hoodoo is not just African magic. If it was just African magic, you could go to Uganda and study it. Right, or Zaire, or the Democratic Republic of Congo, or South Africa, or someplace. You know what I mean? That is not, we're not studying exactly Congo magic, or Zulu magic, or Yoruba magic, or we're studying American magic. So when you think about African Americans, what's the predominant religion of African Americans? Christianity. What's the predominant denomination? Baptist. I mean, that's a no-brainer. Two no-brainer questions. Shouldn't even be good enough questions to get on Jeopardy. Everybody knows that, right? So, Baptist. So now we're talking about Baptists practicing folk magic. Well, that's good. But that's what, you know, but when it's transmitted, it's going to come with prayers. And those prayers usually involve God the Father, God Son, God the Holy Ghost, amen, or in Jesus' name, amen, especially in Jesus' name, amen. Now, we're dealing with Jewish occult shop owners and numbers runners and other pharmacists and other places in which the Jewish folk magical subculture interacted, particularly places like Harlem, Philadelphia, I mean Harlem, New York City, Philadelphia, Chicago, Memphis. There was a lot of that. The Jews tended to, as I say, they want to make friends, and so they tend to work what's called, among my Black Baptist friends, Old Testament mm-hmm. Christianity. They didn't want to, it's Old Testament magic, old, you know, so it's a lot of use of the Psalms. And there are old Jewish, you know, Kabbalistic works on the use of the Psalms, secrets of the Psalms and so forth. So we see that. And then, of course, the Baptists tend to add Jesus into the mix. I don't find a problem with it myself. I was raised to be, you know, to learn the folklore of all my playmates, and so I try to play with everyone. Mm-hmm. But I do not accept students in my class anymore. I used to, but it became a problem. I do not accept students in my class who have a problem with Black culture or Black Christian churches.
Mm-hmm.
I have no reason to teach those people. Let them go study with Silver Ravenwolf or mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a responsibility to them. My responsibility is to reflect back into Black culture, Black folk ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm here to do. And, so if someone says, well, I really like Hoodoo, but I just don't like Jesus, and I don't like Black people, and I don't like, you know, whatever. I mean, I just go, you know, well, go someplace else. You don't have to study with me.
Right.
I don't have to serve you.
Now, you mentioned the neo-pagan interest in Hoodoo, and that's something we find a lot on our blog, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that there's just a surge in popularity in these American magical systems. Are you seeing that on your end as well?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, about 2 or 3 years ago, Hoodoo became, you know, the magic du jour. I mean, a lot of people began to pick up on it. But this has actually been going on for a lot longer than that. If you go back to the Grimoire of Lady Dishiba, do you know that book?
Mm-hmm. I do. It's one of the Wiccan, the first Wiccan book,
yeah.
Book of Shadows.
By mm-hmm. Jessie Wicker Bell, who called herself Lady Shiba. The Grimoire of Lady Shiba was a very early Book of Shadows in the Wiccan tradition, and it contains several hoodoo candle spells.
Really?
They're right there. Yeah, right there. And they come out of what I would call the Henri Gamache, oracle craftsman style of urban hoodoo, but they're right there. And Anna Riva, who was a cult shop owner who worked in a more or less pantheistic style, I mean, she did everything.
Mm-hmm.
She used a lot of hoodoo in her work, too, and served the hoodoo community. So that's kind of an interesting thing that, you know, because Anna Riva's stuff was taken up in somewhat by Wiccan. And another one was Sybil Leek. And Sybil Leek, who was a British traditional witch, came to America. She became friends with a woman named Charmaine Day. Now, Charmaine Day was a white girl of Polish background. She was married to a guy named Steve Day. And she had been a stripper, you know, a burlesque stripper.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Day was a dancer. He did a kind of eccentric tap dancing, and they traveled around, and they were together, and they were in the South at one point, traveling in the South, and she went to a drugstore called the Bichon Drugstore in Houston. This I have, by the way, from a man who was a student of hers and worked with her under the name of Tarot Star.
Hmm.
And he published a bunch of books of spells. He's retired and now lives in Canada. Well, his name is George Benin. Well, anyway, he's from Ohio. June Zablowski was her name, June Zablowski Day. She, under the name of Charmaine the Champagne Blonde, had traveled around. And she was in Houston. She went to the Bichon Drugstore. And Bichon Drugstore was a drugstore that served the hoodoo community in Houston. And she learned how to do this kind of spell work. She ended up in Las Vegas, and she opened a shop called Bell Book and Candle. And she was a friend of people like Anna Riva. She was very well connected. She published a book called The Magic Candle. It's a very, very popular book on hoodoo candle magic. But she was another one of these people like me who kind of fell into this thing when, I like this. And she wrote some of it down and created a store built around it. She died in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
But her influence was very strongly felt because of her publishing this book, The Magic Candle. The point I'm trying to get to here is that she had a huge influence on the neo-pagan community in Las Vegas and elsewhere eventually. Tarot Star, a lot of these people, during the period when the neo-pagan American groups were branching out from Gardnerian Wicca. Have you ever read Aidan Kelly's Crafting the Art of Magic?
I've read parts of it, but I haven't read the entire text yet.
Well, it's a very, very good book. And also Margot Adler's Drawing Down the Moon. Mm-hmm. Those books really tell a story about how what had started off as this kind of lineage-driven Wicca from England kind of spread out into eclectic witchcraft when so many people found that they themselves had family traditions that were like English family traditions, but they had no lineage. And there was a sort of recreation and fiddling around with the lineages and religious aspects of it to make eclectic witchcraft, traditional witchcraft, American traditional witchcraft, Appalachian granny magic, and all these different little groups, you know, mm-hmm. family traditions and so forth. But that did not happen in the African-American community. They just basically stay Baptist. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The reason being that there had never been a condemnation of magic so strong in the Baptist Church. Now, Church of God in Christ and some of these other black denominations were very anti-magic. Leaving those aside, Jehovah's Witness has a large number of black people in Jehovah's Witness, and they condemn mm-hmm. magic, like all the Jehovah's Witnesses do, including mm-hmm. the white ones. But leaving all that aside, and I'm just talking about the majority of black families in America know some of these tricks. And they practiced them, and there was no Calvinistic thou shalt not push against the magic part of it, so there was no need to, quote, change religions to a magic-accepting religion. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Absolutely.
So what happened is kind of just the staying within the Baptist faith or any of these Assemblies of God or some of these, you know, some of these rather unusual small denominations of black churches. And the spiritualist church and the spiritual church movement. Spiritualist churches now are usually defined as white. Spiritual church movement now usually defined as black, but those are flexible, very flexible lines. Mm-hmm. But spiritual church had a large component of black participants starting in the 19th century, and the spiritualist churches stood up for abolition of slavery, and they stood up for universal suffrage, including of African Americans and women. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of spiritualist churches that are black spiritualist churches that openly practice magic, and my church is modeled on that mm-hmm. style of doing divination, doing readings for people. Mm-hmm. So those types of, and those would be sometimes referred to as Christian spiritualist churches. And some of them, like there's even one denomination, Metropolitan Church of God in Christ. I mean, it's like, Metropolitan Spiritualist Church of God in Christ. It's mm-hmm. like, whoa, that tells you kind of where they came from and what they held on to, you know. Mm-hmm. So all of these denominations allow divination, allow spiritual practice. Some of the Christian churches did not, and so the people who felt more magically inclined broke off into neo-pagan groups. Mm-hmm. And they have their own historical reasons for wanting to do so, to honor their own ancestors, and that's great. Mm-hmm. I have nothing against that. But yeah, a lot of them are coming into hoodoo or conjure what I call them spell skimmers.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? They
right,
come in and skim the spells off.
Right, they want to get the recipe without
yeah.
necessarily
learning.
Yeah,
I want the recipe, I want the formula, I want the layout of the candles, bye.
Right, and they don't necessarily want to take the cooking course, necessarily.
Right, they don't necessarily want to make friends with the cooks, either.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great point.
And in some cases, they tell outright lies about
really?
Where they got the things from, I mean, where the spells come from. And this is not only true of hoodoo. I have to say, Silver Raven Wolf, and I'm going to be very blunt about this, did this just recently with
powwow.
Barakarai, mm-hmm. with the powwow stuff, which is not called powwows, but it's called Barakarai
trying for someone.
Hexenkraft, you know, or mm-hmm. Whatever. She did this, and she, quote, returned this to its roots. She put in mentions of the goddess Bridget and things like this in what were obviously German folk magic that was German Catholic Christian folk magic.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it shameful of her to do that. Shameful. Those people were not Irish to begin with. What would they be doing with Bridget anyway? Mm. You know, this. And if she wanted to go back, she should have gone back at least to some Bavarian, Southern
Teutonic.
German Catholic, yeah, German Catholic traditions. But she didn't even do that. And in fact, those people have not been pagan in many centuries. They identify as what they are. And when you buy a book like Powell's, it says make the sign of the cross three times. It means make the sign of the cross three times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not her place to tell those people that she knows their culture better than they do. And I found that shameful. And what I'm afraid of is that people are trying to do this with African-American root work.
Mm.
And saying, I'm going to return this to African deities. I'm sorry. I didn't learn anything about African deities when I learned this in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And the people I learned it from didn't learn anything about African deities. Sure, yes. Every once in a while, somebody, my grandfather was from Africa. That's very interesting. And your grandfather did this how? Well, you know, he said, you know, you want to say this and say, make this on the cross. If he was Catholic or if he was Baptist, he would say, you know, you ask this in Jesus' name. You know, I mean, it's what it is. You cannot, cultures are malleable and changeable. And the farther back you go, we all end up in Africa, right? I mean, all
right.
of our DNA comes from Africa. But we're talking about honoring ancestors and ancestral lineages. We should keep those clear and not just make porridge out of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Anyway, end of rant.
No, that's wonderful. I really appreciate you saying that. It's something that I think people don't think seriously enough about that. And it's really refreshing to hear that.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, in my shop, I sell, you know, statues of Ganesh, and I sell statues of Lakshmi and Tara and Buddha, and I have Sho and, you know, the Chinese star gods, and
mm-hmm.
I have, you know, Nang Kwak from Thailand, and I have Jesus, and I have Mary, and I have, you know, statues of all these gods. And I have, you know, those who do not make statues, I have the, you know, the lettering of Allah and, the, you know, things like that. And you know, all of that things I have so that everyone feels at home.
Mm-hmm.
I once met a man who was born Muslim, but he sold Hindu gilded print cards. And he was from Afghanistan. And he taught me a prayer that he himself knew to be Zoroastrian, a prayer that went with the herb aspand. And he said, this is Zoroastrian, but we Muslims say it. And when he told me he was Muslim, and I had just bought some Hindu cards from him, I said, well, if you're Muslim, why do you sell the Hindu things? He goes, I sell all the popular gods. And he said this with this great, great Afghani accent. And I loved it. And so that became a slogan for our shop. We carry all the popular gods.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wondered, what would you do with the unpopular gods? No, but we do. We carry them all. We have things for Thor. We have things, you know. And our idea is everyone can be friends. However, I don't expect, and I will teach you, if you need to know some little Jewish folk magic, I can teach it to you. The hoodoo is what I became associated with mainly, as I said, because no one was doing it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still have a lot in my brain to download. I'll keep on downloading it for a number of years. But there are many, many other things that I serve all people who wish to study indigenous ethnomagicology. That's why we call it the preservation and popularization of indigenous ethnomagicology. And I don't put one above another, but I do want people to understand you can't just pick and choose.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can say to me, oh, Lakshmi, she's just like the Virgin Mary, except she's on a lotus. A lady actually came into my shop and said that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yes, from one perspective, you could say that.
But at the same time,
from another perspective, that's very wrong.
Right, you're dismissing an entire, you know, thousands of years of cultural history
exactly.
by doing that.
Exactly.
So.
I mean, I would say she's more like the Virgin Mary than, say, Brahma is like the Virgin Mary.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's so many different things. There's so many different cultures. Let's look at them all and enjoy them. It's like food. I often make what I call the cooking analogy. If I want to go to a Mexican restaurant, I want to have Mexican food.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, there are fusion restaurants, you know, Asian fusion restaurants, and they're making this kind of, you know, it's part Asian, part French cuisine, and maybe a little bit of Mexican, this and that and the other tossed in, and it's fusion cooking. It's fine, but I like to know about what I'm eating. I want to eat food that comes from a culture that I want to learn about that culture. I may want to go there. But I'll be happy if immigrants from that culture bring a restaurant of that type. When I go for dim sum, I want it to be real dim sum. You know what I mean?
Right, you want to be in Chinatown.
Yeah, well, actually, we've got a great dim sum here in Santa Rosa, California called Hung Ah Dim Sum. It's in an old A&W root beer stand. No kidding, right off of 101. Check it out, Hung Ah Dim Sum in Santa Rosa. It's perfect. It's beautiful. It's as Chinese as they come. And it's really Chinese. It is not McDonald's. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not TV culture. It's not mall culture. It's real dim sum. And so I go to them when I want dim sum. And I hope that people will understand that when you do that, though, you gotta, you know, you gotta pick up a little bit on what Chinese culture is.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and even using that cooking analogy with the fusion, the chefs who do fusion and do it well have been really well trained in each of the individual branches.
Right.
They know how to do French. They know how to do Thai before they ever try to blend them together.
That's right. That's exactly true. Now, I mean, we would all wish that the chaos mages of the world were as intellectually inclined, but they're not. And they tend to, I mean, chaos magic was once a very powerful force. And I endorsed it at one point back in the 80s. I thought, this is interesting, because that was the magical equivalent of fusion cooking. But what I found out was that chaos mages ended up often just going to a lowest common denominator, mm-hmm. and it ends up as porridge again, you know, mm-hmm. just porridge, you know. And one of the interesting things is every culture, just to talk about cooking again, every culture that I've ever been able to find out about has a dish that contains a concentrated protein, either egg, cheese, or milk,
mm-hmm.
Or meat, or fish, some concentrated protein, and wrapped in a carbohydrate envelope.
Mm, like a pierogi or an egg roll?
A ravioli?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A bao, a dim sum bao. Mm-hmm. Every culture has one of these. There's one called fufu in Africa, which is supposed to be made with cassava. There's all these different cultures have made this. But if I'm going to go get fufu, or if I'm going to go get karoshki, or whatever I'm going to go get, it's not going to be the same as ravioli,
mm-hmm.
you see? It's not going to be a Cornish pasty. It's going to be something different. And chicken pot pie, it's always something different. But it would be wonderful. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to go to a food court and they say, this is the food court of the protein and wrapped in carbohydrates. And you could just go for wontons, you know,
mm-hmm.
everything. You would have, you know, pot stickers. It's all here.
Right. Just put it all on a tray and sample each one. Be great.
Yeah, but each one's different,
mm-hmm.
and there's so much history, and there's so much pride of continuity of keeping these cultures alive, and you know, and a hamburger happens to be one of those things.
Oh, but you've even thought of that, but that's great.
But we shouldn't always all eat hamburgers.
Right. Right. To hit a fun topic really quickly, I've heard that you were the official consultant on a movie about hoodoo called The Skeleton Key.
Yeah,
What was that experience like?
It was interesting and frustrating. I've worked with other movie companies too and done other kinds of consulting, so it was interesting. The screenwriter had never been in a conjure shop before in his life. They mm-hmm. sent him up, actually, to come here. He was a very nice young man. I said, so how many conjure shops were you in to research conjure shops? He goes, this would be conjure shop number one. At least he was honest about it.
Right.
He had some ideas that were just, I don't know, they were eccentric. He was a good screenwriter in that he wrote things that he thought would play well on camera, but they didn't necessarily have anything to do with conjure. So, for instance, just, and again, I'm not trying to put him down. He was a very, very adaptable, very nice young man. He wanted there to be a spell, and he was going to use he wanted it to have water. There was a theme of water. I don't know if you've seen the movie. There was mm-hmm. a huge theme of water. And the filmmaker was building and amplifying this theme of water constantly running throughout the movie, raining and mm-hmm. water. So he wanted to make a scene that the writer did, in which there was a bowl of water with a candle, and it was going to be a spell with water running down. There was going to be a chant that was going to involve water. And so he decided to have a floating candle. What is this? Like Martha Stewart's living, you know what I mean? We'll have that little floating candle. You know, he didn't know, of course, think about it, floating candles. First of all, that's whipping air into the candle. You know, that's so 70s, you know, these mm-hmm. floating candles, the patio light floating candle. And even candles in hoodoo only date back to, you know, the refining of petroleum into making you know, commonly made candles, because before that everyone used kerosene lamps and whale oil lamps or whatever, lard, you know, I mean, oil lamps, you know, you just have to think about this, and we're at the floating candle. So I said, all right, well, we're going to make it the urban hoodoo. Let's use a crucifix candle and put it in a bowl of water. We could do that. So I actually made up a spell, because I couldn't tell him a traditional spell because he didn't have this candle in the water. Mm-hmm. They needed the candle in the water so that the actress could drop it and it would break and fall, and it would be a scary moment.
Mm-hmm.
See? So what I did was take what they needed for drama and then warped it back toward hoodoo as it really exists. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's really good to know that.
Yeah, so that's not an authentic spell, but I did the best I could with the dramatic constraints. There was another thing. There was a thing where we needed to get clues that these people who were the evil people,
mm-hmm.
had switched bodies a number of times, and that in previous life they had had black bodies. And so there were supposed to be little clues along the way, which there were. And it was a scene where she was this elderly white woman who was actually an elderly black woman in a white woman's body, was supposed to kind of give away a little bit. And she was asking the young heroine to help her with her gardening. And so I inserted that she used a name for a plant that was an African-American folk common name for the plant and not an Anglo-American folk name.
Oh.
So that if you were aware of it, you would get the, you'd go, wait a minute, that name, that, she shouldn't be using that, that's black, and it should make you actually go, huh? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, because it was a giveaway. So I just peppered the thing, you know, with all these kinds of little bits like that. We also supplied them with thousands and thousands of dollars of
Lucky Mojo products.
Conjure shop things for a scene that lasted less than 10 seconds.
Yes.
I mean, they just sort of ran the camera right by that, which was funny because we basically outfitted them with an entire hoodoo shop.
Oh, that's...
But they didn't use that. They just sort of ran right past it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I also, I think I was responsible for, and they accepted it very early on, the line that this is not voodoo. And we worked on the writing of that one little, again, like two sentences. This isn't voodoo, this is African-American folk magic. That was inserted. And then another thing that was done, the screenwriter, again, a young white man, had no idea about black music, and he came up with this whole idea of these old recordings, these field recordings, which was a very clever idea. It was wonderful, but we had to displace the time. Originally, it was set in a certain time, and we had to explain that time wouldn't work for those recordings, and so they changed it around.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good. That all worked out just fine. But then there was a little bit more having to do with the song. He wanted to have this music, this recording, he called it call and response.
Oh.
And the way he had written the song was not call and response. He had written a white style of white gospel, which is actually called call and echo. It's different than call and response.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about in terms of music? Again, I'm musical.
Yes.
Obsessive, so I expect everyone to know. But for instance, call and echo would be, see that conjure man shed his skin, and then the echo is see that conjure man shed his skin.
Right. Whereas call and response is
call and response. We see that conjure man shed his skin. Oh Lord, oh Lord. It's something
right.
different. You
mm-hmm.
see, it's a call and a response. And he didn't know the difference, so he had written this rather long piece of music. Lyrics that was supposed to be this thing, and when they flew me down, I gave a lecture there. I was there for a day. They flew me in basically to talk to the art department and talk to the director and talk to the music librarian about what we were going to do to bring this kind of make it more authentic. So, when the music person was there, when I went down, the director's assistant was an African American young woman, and I sort of interesting. I said to her, "What did you think of this screenplay?" And I didn't want to get her in trouble or anything. I just was private. And I said, "What did you think of the screenplay?" And she said, "Well, it's got a few problems." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I think that's why they've called me in." I said, "Bear with me." I said, "You know, I'm not black, but I think I know what we can do to help this." And she was like, "Well," she goes, "this is my first big job." I said, "I understand. We're not going to get there." But I did do something funny, and I consider it a funny story, which I will tell. You know, so I'm trying to explain to this English director. This man's British, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this English director has done a beautiful, beautiful movie, prior movie on the history of the Beatles, I mean, this guy did really great movies. He was really neat. But he didn't know a lot about American culture. And I said, the difference between Call and Response and Call and Echo. And I said to her, I just turned to this young black woman there and I said, if I was to sing a song to you and you were to do Call and Response, could you, do you know what I'm talking about? She goes, yeah. I said, and I just said to her, Jesus on the Main Line. And she said, tell them what you want. And the director, he was very intelligent. He looked at that and he goes, I get it. But it just, you know, I was brought in there as an expert, but I didn't want to, quote, be an expert. I wanted to show them, though, that they needed to delve a little deeper into the things they were playing with.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a fiction. It was a horror movie, you know. But they needed to, so that was my role. I just simply kind of kept them focused on African-American culture. That was it.
Well, excellent. Well, I enjoyed the movie, so thank you for all your contributions to that.
Well, yeah, you're welcome, sure. And I gave them a CD of a whole lot of songs put together. And, you know, I brought them a lot of homework is what I did. I brought them a lot of products and showed them how to use them. I showed them how to do a bathing ritual, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, I hate to monopolize all your time, so I guess we should wrap up here.
Well, yeah, we've certainly talked for quite a while, and you know me, I'll talk forever.
Anytime
you want to talk to me again, I'll be glad to.
Wonderful. If people want to find a root worker nearby, do you have any tips on how they might do that?
Well, a lot of root workers work by mail. We do have a group of, these are people who are graduates of my course and have at least 2 years practice root working, and you can find them at AIR, Association of Independent Readers and Root Workers, which is run by Missionary Independent Spiritual Church, an outreach to the client community. These are all root workers who have taken an ethical oath not to rip people off, and we have an ombudsman if you have trouble with anybody. And it's at readersandrootworkers.com, which is all spelled out, readersandrootworkers.com. Or you can find it by going just to rootworkers, with an S on the end, rootworkers.com. Or you can find it by going to kudupsychics.com.
Right.
And that is readersandrootworkers.org is another way to find it. We own a bunch of related sites. And there's names. There's about 22 people who are very good workers, and they're all around the country, California, Ohio, Texas, you name it, Georgia, they're all around.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We will definitely have links to that in the show notes, as well as links to Cat Ironwood's wonderful shop, yeah, luckymojo.com.
And can I put in one more plug?
Yes, absolutely.
My good friend, Dr. Keone, at drkeone.com, he and I have had a radio show for many years, and we're starting our own new season on September 19th.
Wonderful.
And it's the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Root Work Hour. And it's a call-in show. It will be every Sunday, 3 p.m. California time, 6 p.m. Eastern time. You can call in and ask questions about your own case. In other words, we take people's cases and give them some suggestions about spell work they can do and prayers they can say. And that will be me and Dr. Keone together again.
Great. Is there a website for that?
Well, that you can find that through Lucky Mojo or through My Hoodoo Space, which is .com, which is Keone's site. And you can also find it through the Lucky Mojo Forum, which is forum.luckymojo.com. And we have a forum where you can ask questions about hoodoo and stuff.
Great. And I know that some of those were released as podcasts. That's how I've listened to a lot of them.
Yes, these will be podcasts also. Yeah.
Great. Excellent. Well, Ms. Ironwood, thank you so much for this interview. I really appreciate it.
Sure, and thanks very much for having me.
Wonderful.
Good luck with you. All right.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Hello, this is Firelight, creator of Inciting a Riot, the podcast. Come join the riot as I tackle tough issues in paganism, news, and living a modern, magical, middle-class life. Find the show on iTunes or become a rioter by following the blog at fire-lyte.blogspot.com. Inciting a Riot, lighting a fire under comfortable thinking.
We'll be right back. Hi, this is Meadow Moon, and you can find me at A Pagan in the Threshold, where I will be discussing mostly pagan-related topics. I'm a work-from-home homeschooling mom of two located in South Carolina. In addition to that, I'm a case manager for a local paranormal group, and I have a bachelor's degree in alternative medicine. So I think it's pretty safe to say that we'll have plenty to talk about. You can find me at meadowmoon.com and on iTunes. So I invite you to join me as I hit rewind on my pagan beliefs and start back at square one.
So that was the lovely, the brilliant, the articulate, and the intelligent Kat Ironwood. We will be posting links to all of the various sources of information that she mentioned in the interview in our show notes. And for now, if you're looking for her main website, you can go to luckymojo.com and find pretty much everything she's ever written, either on that site or through that site. All very brilliant stuff. And we really appreciate her being on and giving us that interview.
Yeah, definitely. I really wish I could have been there for it. But, you know, it just didn't work out. But that's okay.
Why weren't you there? Why, Elaine? Why?
I had to work.
When we needed you the most.
I know.
You failed.
I know. Like, one of our biggest interviews. And
I know.
I had to work. But
it's terrible.
What are you going to do? So, anyway, we wanted to discuss the interview a little bit. You know, some of the points she brought up. And so, yeah, let's get to that. How was it interviewing her? What was it like?
It was really nerve-wracking. I'm going to be totally honest. That is the most nervous I've ever been for an interview.
Were you starstruck?
I was a little starstruck.
Because I know you really have learned a lot from her. Not, like, directly, but, you know, through books and her website and everything.
Yeah. I mean, she's been sort of the overall guiding force in my education on particularly hoodoo.
Mm-hmm.
If for no other reason than she points me to a lot of other good sources and other good books.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, teachers, of course, as well. So yeah, so very nerve-wracking to talk to her.
Yeah.
Thankfully, like, she has done this sort of thing so often that really I just threw a couple of questions out there and she ran with them.
Yeah.
So that was great. I really didn't have to worry too much about sounding like a complete idiot.
There's
only like 30 seconds of me sounding like an idiot, and then the other like 55 minutes of it is her being amazing. So, what about you? How was it listening to it? What did you react to?
I was very struck by some of the history that she gave.
Mm-hmm.
That was fascinating. We were talking about it earlier, but I'll repeat it now.
Yes, please do.
You know, just that it's stuff that you probably could have figured out for yourself, but, like, you didn't really think about. I know I didn't. You know, that, you know, slaves came over, they had particular ways of doing things with, you know, roots and plants over there,
mm-hmm.
and they come over here, and there's not any of that. Yet they're still expected to do this healing and, you know, other things. And, speaking of sounding stupid. but yeah, so, and having to adapt, and it's just and pulling from, you know, the Christianity and the Native American, and it's just...
And all the various things that had to come together in that salad,
yeah.
as she put
and
it.
And I'm sure there were different tribes that all came together,
mm-hmm.
you know, from like North Africa and South Africa, you know, you're going to have two different ways of doing things, and that's got mixed in. I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was really kind of a good history lesson, a good education. So, and you heard it here, folks, at New World Witchery. That's fantastic. So what else struck you?
I loved when she talked about the movie. That mm-hmm. was fun. Hearing about, you know, her going in and being like, no, you can't do that. And then the spell that she made up. And
yeah, that was awesome, wasn't it? Like, I totally thought that was a legitimate real spell when I saw that movie.
Really?
Yeah, totally bought it.
Wow.
Hook, line, and sinker.
Well, I mean, it makes sense. You know, she has so much knowledge of it that she could make one up, and it seems very real.
And it was well done. Fooled me. I loved it. You know, it's one of those things that, well, you know, she's got all that background and she's done her homework in
mm-hmm.
it. So she's able to take those building blocks and turn it into something that looks so real.
Yes.
Which is really neat.
Agreed.
I loved the part where she was talking about the assistant, the set assistant, the African-American set assistant,
mm-hmm.
who... You know, she's talking to her about what was going on. The set assistant's like, yeah, I've never seen that stuff before in my life. And then Kat's like, well, what about this? She's like, oh, no, that's real. He's like, yeah, that's what I'm going to go tell him right now. So.
And the callback and the echoing
stuff. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I've never done any of that, obviously, but like when she said it, I just sort of knew what she was talking about. I was like, well, echoing and call, you know, that makes sense. Why would they not get that?
Yeah, well, honestly, I think it has something to do with being Southern.
You think?
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of gospel music, and I mean, you can't live in the South without at least bumping up against gospel music every once in a while. I mean, yeah. It's played on radio stations here that have nothing to do with gospel music sometimes. Yeah. So you hear that a lot of gospel music is either call and response or call and echo.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't avoid it. And I think that just has to do with being Southern. You've probably encountered that more than you realize. It's one of those things that like...
Must be. I don't know. I've never heard that phrasing though, but...
Right.
I still know what she was talking about though.
Right, and that's just it, is I think probably, you know, did you ever, like, go to church with any of your friends when you were little?
Yeah, occasionally, but we didn't really sing anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said you went to church, Church of Christ.
Yeah, but it was all hymns.
Right, but those hymns are call and response sometimes.
I don't remember any of them that are. I just remember, you know, a couple. Mm-hmm. We kind of stuck to the same ones. Mm-hmm. And plus, whenever I was there, I was miserable, so.
So, not a positive experience.
I tend to block it. The songs was about the only thing that I liked, so.
My wife is a big fan of the hymns at her church, which is also a Church of Christ. And some of the, like, the, I don't, I love to, I wish I could think of an actual hymn that's a call and response
Me
hymn.
Me too.
But I know that a lot of times they'll divide them so that the men will have the call and the women will have the response, or vice versa. And those are always really interesting.
I just think it's so pretty.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's all a cappella, of course. Mm-hmm. So it's beautiful.
So let's.
Never heard. Yeah, but you've never heard so much about Christianity and him singing on a podcast about witchcraft.
Yeah, because we've talked about this before.
Yeah. Goodness gracious.
We don't have to talk about this. We can totally cut this part. But do you want to get into some of the little bit more of the controversial stuff that she talked about?
Sure.
Let's throw
it out there. And if
yeah.
Not, then I've got a gap there.
Yeah. Well, she, she brought up having to be comfortable with Jesus. Uh-huh. And, what did you think of that? What was your take on it?
I'm totally on board with that, but then again, I am.
Right.
I mean, if I'm going to church with my wife every Sunday, then...
You're obviously comfortable.
I'm okay
with it.
See,
and I'm not as comfortable with it, so I don't know. I wonder what her reaction to me would be.
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to obviously ask her yourself.
But... Yeah, I mean, and I'm not saying, like... Like, that's a challenge. Like, oh, come on, Kat, bring it, you know? Like, right. I don't mean it like that. I'm just, I don't know.
I think she has had a number of healthy, stable interactions with pagans and neo-pagans that have been very positive experiences. So mm-hmm. I don't think that she would come up to you and just be like, oh, you're a neo-pagan or you're pagan, and therefore you have no place.
Oh, no, I don't think that either.
I don't think she would ever be that way. I think what she would say is, if you're really going to study hoodoo, if you're really going to make the most of it and not just use it as sort of an archive or a mine for spells,
mm-hmm.
but if you're really going to get into it, you're going to have to be really comfortable talking to and interacting with black people, which is a huge part. I mean, the course that she does is there's a whole, one of the whole modules is basically you just go and hang out with African Americans and talk to them about their family lore.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not doing it just so that you can get their family lore, but just so that you understand that that's part of the hoodoo background.
Right, and where they're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah, you get the social context of it.
Yeah.
And then you also need to be comfortable with Christianity, because Christianity is... It was sort of the bowl in which that salad was made. Or you know, it's one of the kinds of lettuce. You know, it's a pretty big component. You can't study hoodoo without coming up to Christianity and without being comfortable with a little bit of Christianity
right.
mixed in there. But that being said, I personally think that you can do hoodoo without praying, you know, praying to Jesus as an exclusive entity, without praying to God as a singular, you know, Jehovah in Old Testament wrathy kind of way.
Right. Well, and, you know, you could make the point that hoodoo is not a religion. It's a magical system.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, and you, I mean, You don't want to put stuff there that doesn't belong there. Like she was talking about with Silver Ravenwolf's Hexencraft book, or what does she call it? Maybe Hexcraft is what she called it. I can't remember what she called it.
I can't remember either. Silver Ravenwolf calls it powwow.
Right, but there, she calls what she does powwow in the book, but the book itself, I think, is called Hexcraft.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And she actually even has a little podcast that she was doing for a little while. I've only heard a couple of episodes of it. And it's not available on a regular stream. Like, you have to kind of dig for it. But a lot of the things she does, like she was saying, you know, she'll throw in, you know, a Celtic goddess, like Breed.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, who, yes, because of the Catholic connection, you could say, okay, so she became a Catholic saint. Therefore, when she's brought into this Teutonic area through Catholicism, maybe she gets adopted into the Germanic lore. But it's a stretch to do that. And I'm not saying that I know that I don't know that that's what Silver Ravenwolf did. I have no idea.
Right, we haven't read the book.
Yeah, we have no idea really how that all is structured. But that's something to be careful of.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to start doing hoodoo and then just assume that you can instantly bring in
ISIS.
Well, actually, I would say ISIS would be more okay than others because ISIS is an African deity. It's Egyptian. She's an Egyptian deity. But at least that's African. There might be a reason to go back there. But you have to find that. You have to actually do the research to make that work. But, you know, you wouldn't... Kuan Yin would have no place in hoodoo. Well, I say that. Dadgummit. Because there is actually an Asian, like the Chinatown influence
right.
on later hoodoo. I could see it connecting that way. Gosh, who wouldn't... Thor.
There we go.
Thor has no place in hoodoo. If you're using Thor in hoodoo, no. Stop right now. Bad. No hoodoo biscuit for you. If you are and you can explain why, that's awesome. Anyway, but no, so like Thor is completely alien to anything that hoodoo grew up in.
Right.
So why would you bring Thor into it? But you wouldn't bring Thor into it. I don't think you would.
No.
So, and when you do hoodoo, you're not, like, that's something I think with your hoodoo, and please correct me if I'm wrong
on this,
but when you're doing hoodoo, spirits don't enter into it a whole lot.
No.
Gods, spirits, entities don't enter into it a whole lot.
No, I do it very much as a magical system.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, yeah, you're right.
And I would say I do it as a magical system, but the spirits do enter into it, so it's, but they're not. They're not particularly religious spirits. They're just sort of spirits. They're like people.
But some people would consider that religious.
Some would. I just don't.
Right.
So
anyway.
But I know, I want to know more about you. So when you do your hoodoo without the spiritual context, can you explain that a little bit?
No. I don't know what you mean. Like.
Well, okay. I'm kind of putting you on the spot with this.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Well done, Corey. But, okay, so you were saying that you think that she would be like, oh, no, you know, bad neo-pagan.
No, I don't think she would say that. I think she wouldn't accept me into her class.
Because you have an issue with Christianity.
I don't even want to say that. I'm just not comfortable with it. I grew up in it. It made me just guilt-ridden, and it made me feel awful about myself, mm-hmm. and I just don't like it for me. I don't mean, like, I don't like the people who do it. I don't like it as a religion. I just mean I don't like it for me. So I do think she wouldn't accept me.
Well.
But that's okay. Like, I'm not saying, oh, Kat, I'm so sad. It's just, you know.
This isn't a desperate plea to try and get into her class.
Right.
You don't need to get into her class.
No, it's just, I don't, you know, just from what I gathered from her interview.
And I don't know, this is something I'd be interested to ask her if we ever have her back on. But I don't necessarily know that she wouldn't accept you into her class if, because like you just said, you don't have a problem with people being Christian. You don't have a problem with anybody around you being, you wouldn't have a problem talking to a Christian person about their magical practices.
Right.
Where does that come in for you? Where is it like, where's the cutoff for you?
Praying to Jesus.
Okay.
You know, using Christian saints, you know, anything like that. It doesn't do anything for me. It feels fake to me.
Okay. That makes a lot more sense to me now.
All right.
So you would feel kind of like you were a poser.
A little bit.
If you were trying to use. But And this is something I'm curious about.
Okay.
Like, for example, if you had someone that you were doing a house cleansing for, mm-hmm. right? And you knew that they worked with primarily a Celtic pantheon, and they were pagan, and you were trying to help them do something, and you don't really work with Celtic deities yourself. I know that you used to work a lot with Egyptian. Is that right?
No, I was interested in it. I did some, like, research on it, but I never worked with...
Was it more Greek?
Yeah.
Greco-Roman kind of?
Yeah.
Yeah, classical.
Okay. Some people may want to take my pagan card after this, but a lot of times I wouldn't assign any... Like, I didn't have any specific pantheon. I just sort of was like, you know, god and goddess, and it was... They just were. You know, they weren't any particular one.
Okay, but if somebody... Well, okay, that's interesting, because I think that you could really be comfortable with Christianity in that respect.
Really?
Yeah, because you also sort of believe there's sort of another level above that that's sort of the all,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, I do.
Well, that could be God.
Yeah.
Christians call God.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
but
so
see, I see God as part of that whole.
But that's just a terminology.
Yeah, that's very true. This is getting very...
Very complicated.
Yeah.
But anyway, no, I just think that's interesting because I think that you could come at it from a point of view of, you know, if somebody had a Celtic pantheon that they were a really big fan of, you probably would tell them, we'll pray to your Celtic pantheon. You wouldn't tell them, pray to the god and goddess that I'm telling you to pray to. Would you?
I don't know. If I were to do a cleansing spell, I wouldn't say, okay, let's pray together. And, you know, I would say, I'll do my thing. If you want to do something else, you can.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you pray to who you pray to, and I'll pray to who I pray to.
And I think that would be fine.
Yeah. But it wouldn't be like, okay, you know, we'll pray to whoever you want to. Because if I wasn't comfortable with that, I wouldn't feel like it would be as effective.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm wondering, though, like, because, and I understand what you mean about the sort of feeling fake with prayers to Jesus,
mm-hmm.
because clearly that, you know, that could be crossing a line.
Yeah.
But I don't know, like, I think, like, you could go in there and be like, I want to pray to who I'm going to pray to. You pray to who you need to pray to. And we're going to do these things and get this house clean.
Right.
And I think that's basically the same thing that Kat would do in hoodoo.
I don't know.
I don't know. Like, that, we'd need to have her back on to discuss that.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I just don't know.
But yeah, I hope this doesn't, like, come across as, like, I have a problem with anything she said or I'm upset or anything like that. I just think it was very interesting, and I thought it'd be fun to talk about because it's kind of, you know, controversial a little
bit. It is. And yeah, I think we'll definitely get feedback on that.
Yeah.
I hope we do.
Yeah.
It may not be positive, but
well, that's okay.
So.
It can't all be positive. That's okay.
Yeah. And we've learned that you hate Christians. That well. She's eaten like 6 of them today.
It's true.
It's sad. Babies especially. Just so tender.
Nom, 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 nom.
Delicious baby. Delicious Jesus baby. Nom, nom, nom.
A picture. Jesus has a 6-pound.
8-ounce baby Jesus. I like the Christmas Jesus. Oh, yeah, we just quoted Talladega Nights.
Yes, we did.
Oh, goodness. In an earlier version of this, we quoted Ratatouille, so mm-hmm. we're doing real well on citing legitimate
sources.
Yeah,
we were having a problem with this conversation tonight for some reason.
Yeah.
Third time's a charm.
Yeah. Charm.
Okay, so I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Anything else to talk about?
I don't think so. We hit the movie Salad. Discussed Salad, yes.
I think so.
All right. So, yeah, I think that's about it.
Yeah, I guess we'll take a break and come back with witchcraft.
Get all nice and soapy.
Yay!
Okay. All right, we'll be back in a minute.
Okay, so today in witchcraft, we're going to be talking about soap making. So to get started with that, you would...
We probably should clarify first of all... When we're saying soap making in this particular segment,
mm-hmm.
You're not going to take them through how to, you know, render lard and
lye.
Make lye water.
No.
We're doing a quick and dirty, simple way.
Yes, this is a very easy way. And if you want to do it the hard way, you know, like with have a hand in every single thing, then that's totally understandable. But information, I'm sure, is online. So.
Or I'm sure somebody will do a blog post about it eventually.
Or that, or Corey may. So this is the quick and dirty way to do it. So you can buy blocks of make-your-own soap at craft stores?
Yeah.
Stuff like that?
They'll be in, like, you can get goat's milk or olive oil, like really good quality stuff.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I should point out to, before we start, Corey has done this, I haven't, so he will be chiming in occasionally on this, which is totally fine. So, okay, you're going to get your own soap, and then you're going to cut it, you know, into the size that you want. It's usually pre-scored, and then you melt it, and you can either do it over the stovetop with a double boiler, or you can melt it in the microwave, and that you want to do at about 50% power with, 30-second intervals until it's melted properly.
Mm-hmm. It'll be kind of like a thick soup.
Okay. That's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish I could have done that with you.
We'll do a soup making day again at some point.
That'd be fun.
Especially now that we've come up with our new idea with it.
Yes.
That'd be fun.
So anyway, so you can, and also you can add oils and herbs. And this is probably what's going to make it, like, you know, magical soap. So, you know, add the herbs that you want. I know Corey did one that had verbena in it, I believe. It was very lemony scented. Yes. And that one was great.
Yeah.
So, and that would be a really good cleanser. Mm-hmm. Just,
magical cleanser, spiritual cleanser.
Yes. It's like you talked about last spelled out, you know, the lemon. There's a reason why so many cleansers are use lemon, because that citrus is a cleanser. Mm-hmm. So, and you can also add oils to it. But the oils, you want to wait for the soap to cool just a little bit, or else it's going to evaporate too quickly. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind. Once it cools down just a little bit, you're going to pour it into the molds that you have and let it set.
And also, if for some reason you want to add some food coloring to change the color of the soap, you can certainly do that.
Okay.
Do it before you pour it into the molds when you're adding the essential oils.
Okay. Some people might not like that because of the artificialness of
and
it.
And that's totally fine. I'm just saying, if that's your bag, then
but, you know, but the color might be great for, you know, certain correspondences that you might need. And
exactly.
It won't stain your skin or anything, will it?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No, because you're not going to use, one, you're not going to use very much, but just a few drops, maybe, you know, 5 to 10, would color a whole batch of soap a nice light color.
Okay.
So
you have a lot of things that can, I guess, influence how it works. Like we said, the oils, the herbs, and then also, you know, you can pour it into different shapes. For the molds, and that would, what am I trying to say here? I lost it.
It might help, like, guide the purpose of
exactly.
The sort of spell that the soap is designed for.
Yes.
Like, if for some reason you were making, like, your sort of witchy pre-ritual soap, a star.
Yes. Like, that's what I was thinking, star stuff. But, you know, then you could just do squares and have it be just regular soap. Another idea that Corey had, which I thought was really, really interesting, is to put a stone in the middle of it and let it dry that way, and, you know, use it until you get down to the stone. And so that stone is going to, or crystal, or whatever you want to call it, is going to, I guess, imbue the soap with its power. That sounds really, really floofy, but
it's a little puffy.
Yeah.
But no, like, you know, if you do work with stones, there's no reason you couldn't add that to the soap. I mean, you'd want to make sure it's not a stone that decomposes in water.
Yeah.
You know, you want to make sure it's one that you don't mind getting some damage, getting wet. But there are plenty of stones that you can do that with. And you also want to make sure it's not one with a lot of jagged pointy bits.
Yeah, that's true.
Look for something round and tumbled.
Yeah, get a tumbled one. So, yeah, that's soap making. Oh, you had another little hint to give.
Oh, yes. When you've got them in their molds and you're letting them cool and dry, and it'll take, I would generally say let them sit overnight, you know, in their molds to really set. But while they're doing that, right after you've gotten them poured in, if you get a little spritzer bottle and put some ethyl alcohol, not isopropyl, you want the kind that's made from natural grain as opposed to petroleum. But you take that alcohol, vodka, good strong vodka will do this too. Put it in your spritzer bottle, and from a good distance away, just sort of spritz the back of all the soap in the molds, and it will keep the little tiny bubbles from forming all over the backs and making your soap look funny. It'll, as the alcohol evaporates, it'll pop those bubbles.
That's really cool.
It makes them nice and smooth. Hmm. So, it's very cool. And the alcohol won't do anything. After you get the soap wet, the alcohol's gone, so.
So, before we wrap up, what are some of the herbs that you used in yours?
Oh, snap. You totally turned it around.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. Well, obviously, in the cleansing one was the lemon. I used lemon. I think I may have used Van or... No, I used verbena essence, and I used... No, I'm sorry. I used vetiver essence.
Mm-hmm.
And then I used lemon balm, and then pieces of lemon peel and lemon essential oil as well in there. And that was like a good, like, strip it all away, get it all off of you
right.
kind of thing. And I did one, and this is good. Either people will laugh at me, or they'll be like, oh, he doesn't know what he's doing. I totally made a mint oatmeal.
Oh, really?
Because I wanted to see if it actually was effective as a shaving soap. Because it's what they talk about in Practical Magic, and I thought
it was
really
funny.
I knew
you were
really going
to say that.
Like, I'm totally making this to see how it works. And it's a great shaving soap. It's amazing.
Is it?
Yeah, because the mint stimulates the skin, and the oatmeal helps, like, get rid of dead skin.
Slough it off.
Yeah, it's great.
Slough. Nah. My husband uses some that has eucalyptus in it. And mm-hmm. But he, like, shaves the old-fashioned way. You know, not with, like, not a Sweeney Todd razor, but, like, the next generation of those.
Right, the old straight razors.
Yes.
Or not straight razors, there's the old safety razors.
Yes, exactly. Where you actually replace the scary blades that people use to commit right. suicide in movies. That's a horrible way to think about it. But anyway, so he has to have like a shaving cream that, mm-hmm. you know, you take the badger hair brush and you, mm-hmm. you know, mix it up and everything. So anyway, he uses this shaving cream and it has eucalyptus in it and it opens your pores. Mm-hmm. And then, so yeah, that makes total sense that it would mm-hmm. work.
Yeah. It seemed to be pretty effective.
Very cool.
And then I did one that had lavender and ginger, which is just sort of a warm, loving, friendly soap. And mm-hmm. I didn't do that one with any magical significance. I was just doing it because I liked the smell.
Okay. Well, you could do lavender for sleep.
Yeah. The ginger probably would not be a good compliment for that.
Probably not, though, because that's more like awake.
Yeah, you could do lavender and chamomile, though, mm-hmm. very, very easily.
Or lavender and vanilla.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll take another quick little break, probably just long enough to play the intro music, and then I'll be back with Spelled Out. All right, welcome to Spelled Out. Today, sort of apropos of Lane's soap segment, we're going to be talking about spiritual cleansing baths. Now, one of the primary sources for what I'm going to be discussing is a book called Spiritual Cleansing by, and I'm probably going to butcher this name, but I believe it's Draja Mikaheritz is his name. He's a sort of an occult scholar who's done dozens of books on magic, and they're all amazing. They often have a lot of hoodoo in them, mixed with a good bit of Eastern European magic, which is very interesting. But anyway, so the baths I'm going to be talking about are baths designed to do basic spiritual cleansing. This is the kind of bath you would take if you're just wanting to go back to neutral. You want to get rid of any negative stuff that's hanging around you. Also good for, you know, prepping yourself in the event that a ritual is coming up. So you could use it as a sort of a pre-ritual bath. I'm going to give sort of three variant recipes on this. The first one I'm going to give is probably the simplest. And it is also one of the ones that may be... so maybe easiest on the skin, but don't do this if you have very, very sensitive skin. If you have very, very sensitive skin, don't do any of these without talking to your physician, I would say, just because you don't want to have a breakout. The simplest form of a good spiritual cleansing bath involves, simple apple cider vinegar and salt.
Hmm.
That's it. And you'll use... just a little handful, not even a full handful, just like a little palm full of salt and like a jar full or a cup full of apple cider vinegar. And what you want to do is you want to put the salt into the vinegar and stir it up to mix it and then pour that into the bath. And when you're taking a ritual bath, the way you want to do it is you want to get into the bath with the ritual mixture put in there. And you want to make sure that you completely submerge yourself at least once. Most workers recommend doing it 3 times or 7 times, some 9 times, 13 times.
Right.
You take these baths at dawn or at sunset if you can't do it at dawn for some reason.
Why those times?
The threshold times.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, you know, it's the times when spirits are most active and, or spirituality is most active. And I'll go through the recipes a little bit more before I get into the ingredients in these. But the idea is that by submerging yourself and completely covering yourself in these things, they will strip away anything harmful from you and leave you clean and pure. When you're done with these, you should air dry.
Right.
And these are not designed to be cleaning baths in terms of your daily shower. If you need to take a daily shower, take your daily shower, then take a spiritual bath.
Okay.
So you want the spiritual bath to be the thing that air dries on you. It's the last thing that happens to you. And they only take a few minutes, really. You know, they're not that detailed. You just want to make sure that you get your head covered and cover your body.
So do you just submerge? Like, you don't have to kind of scrub yourself or rub the water on you or anything like that?
Yeah, if you want to. Okay. I mean, the idea is really that you're just going to get in the tub and make sure you're completely submerged, come back out, stand back up, go back down in. It's just imagine like you're in a river, just dunking yourself.
Okay.
That's what you're really trying to do. Okay, so the other variants on this, you can also do one that involves using water. Preferably you can use either holy water or sea water. Those are both excellent. Again, another little palm full of salt and about a teaspoon to a tablespoon of ammonia. If you have very sensitive skin, don't do this one because ammonia could irritate you, and don't use more than a tablespoon. I mean, even in a full bathtub, you want to be very careful. Ammonia is an amazing spiritual cleaning agent. It does a beautiful job of getting rid of negative things. There are root workers who recommend when you're doing your ritual house cleaning, one of the last things you do is you take a spoonful of ammonia and dump it down every drain in your house.
Huh.
Gets rid of everything. Make sure everything is clean.
Yeah.
So you use that to do the same kind of a cleaning. And then the other variation is, this one's a bit saltier. This is sort of a way to replicate seawater as a cleanser. And you use, you know, a good jar full of baking soda, which is also known as bicarbonate soda. You use about a palm full of table salt and about a palm full to a handful of Epsom salts. All of those are available at your grocery store. Anything that I mentioned here really is available at your grocery store. Salt, of course, is a great neutralizer. It will absorb and scrub away almost anything, sort of replicating a sea bath. If you think about the ocean sort of drawing away in the way that a tide draws away, pulling things out of you. So that's how that works with the salt. The ammonia, again, very, very powerful cleansing agent. That's really all I have to say about those specific baths. If you have any questions about those, please feel free to write and ask if you want the specific recipes. I'll try to post those online as well at some point.
Right, and I'm sure we'll have the book in the show notes as well.
Yes, of course. So yeah, that's it for Spelled Out today.
Awesome.
All right. Well, again, we really want to thank Kat Ironwood for being a wonderful guest on our show.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. And thank you to all of our listeners and readers at the blog. Mm-hmm. We've gotten some really good feedback. Hopefully we'll get around to reading and responding to that specifically. I'm still struggling to keep up with some of the correspondence. So if I haven't responded to you yet, I will. Just give me a little bit of time to get to it, and I will do my best to respond to everybody who writes until that becomes unmanageable. But that shouldn't happen anytime soon. But if you want to write to us, our email address is compassandkey@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. And there's the blog, newellwitchery.wordpress.com.
Mm-hmm. And feel free to drop by anytime. Leave a comment.
Yeah.
Oh, before we sign off, I almost forgot to mention this, but there are going to be, speak English, Corey, a series of concerts coming up called Strowler Nights. And I'm going to post information about this on the blog for everyone. The first concert is going to be held in St. Louis on September 10th, 11th, and 12th, I believe, from 7 p.m. to midnight, featuring artists like S.J. Tucker, Tricky Pixie, Wendy Rule.
We've talked about Tricky Pixie on our media episodes.
They're just so much fun. Yeah. I mean, if you get a chance to see them, they're great. It's just this big, like, carnival-esque event. It's not quite a concert. It's not quite a floor show or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a mix of a lot of different things. It's almost like the Bonnaroo or the Woodstock.
I was just thinking. It sounds like Bonnaroo.
So if you get a chance, it'll be in St. Louis on September 10th, 11th, and 12th, I believe, 7 p.m. to midnight. There will also be festivals in Boston and Seattle. So please check those out. Again, I'll be putting information about this on the actual show notes sometime in the next couple of days after this is out, so everyone can get a chance to see that. We have a special promotion going on right now, sort of in conjunction with Strowler Nights. If you want to see one of these shows, you can go to their website to pre-order tickets, and if you enter the discount code AIRTIME, that's AIRTIME, you'll get 10% off.
So, awesome.
Yeah. So that's just something nice that they're doing, and we just want to pass that on to you guys. So please check that out. Hope you enjoy it. If you go to see that, I'd love to hear about it, which it's not really near enough. None of them are really near enough that I can go see them myself.
Yeah.
But they just sound amazing. It just sounds like so much fun. So, yeah. Well, that'll about do it for this show.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
And be well. New World Witchery is recorded using GarageBand on Mac. The song you're listening to is Homebound by the artist Jag from Cypress Grove Blues. It can be found on magnatune.com. Magnatune, your source for PodSafe music.